KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM. You don't know.
You're listening to KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills, Volume 3, Special Programming Campaign. Check out all the great special programs we're bringing you in February and March at kboo.fm/thrills. Help us reach our goal of $22,000 by March 16th. You can go to kboo.fm/give or text us. Type in KBOO to the number 44321. For the thrill of it all, keep listening.
Tune in to KBOO every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. for Squirrel Snow, the show where we broadcast galactic awareness, animal awareness, where we have fascinating conversations with movers and shakers in the fields of galactic awareness and animal awareness, and we play music that can raise our frequency of consciousness. Yeah, that is Squirrel Snow every fourth Friday of the month at 8 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO, Portland.
Hey, yo, this is Clipping. You're listening to KBOO.
Welcome to Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, your weekly antidote to the doom and gloom of mainstream news, lifting up solutions that bring us closer to economic, racial, gender, and environmental justice. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media. This week, we'll speak with investigative journalist Arun Gupta, whose explosive story in Yes Magazine debunks two major reports of mass sexual violence on October 7th, published by Physicians for Human Rights Israel and the New York Times. Arun will also comment on the recent UN reports of mass rapes. Then Indigenous journalist Frank Hopper, also writing for Yes, will discuss his new story about the first police accountability measure of its kind that voters in Washington State passed. And finally, Sanavi Bridham, managing editor at Yes Media, will preview the new Spring 2024 issue of Yes Magazine, out now and themed around connections. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. In the weeks after the October 7th Hamas attack on Israelis, there were numerous claims about mass rapes by Hamas soldiers of Israeli women. Soon after, in November, the group Physicians for Human Rights Israel released a position paper claiming that mass rapes took place. And then in December, the New York Times published an investigation making similar claims. The two reports were widely cited to justify Israel's brutal and ongoing genocide in Gaza. Now, Yes Magazine has published an in-depth investigation of our own, an unusual undertaking for a solutions journalism outlet like ours, debunking these two reports. And the journalist behind it is Arun Gupta, investigative reporter whose work has appeared in The Washington Post, The Nation, The Daily Beast, The Raw Story, The Guardian, The Intercept, and of course, Yes. His explosive story for Yes is entitled Claims of Mass Rape by Hamas Unravel Upon Investigation. And I should disclose for the audience that I was Arun's editor for the story. Welcome to the program, Arun.
Thanks for having me on, Sonali.
So first, let's talk about these the reports themselves and how seriously they've been taken. They are available to audiences. They're linked from your story. People can read them themselves. And if you just look at those stories, it sounds horrific. It sounds, you know, like something, it can sound very credible for someone who's not an investigative journalist. Is that a major reason why you felt it was important and worth the time, the months that it took for you to debunk them?
Exactly. And also the fact that it was having such an influence on global public opinion. And for anyone who's not well versed in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I don't think they realize how sophisticated Israeli propaganda is. They use this term Hasbara, and they have used these allegations, completely unsubstantiated allegations of mass rape, explicitly to wage a brutal war against Gaza. That was one of the things I reported in my Intercept piece, and will also be in a forthcoming article in Yes Magazine.
Right. So many of the stories, many of the allegations about what happened, you know, horrific sounding allegations, basically were on the basis of about a dozen witnesses, only two of them claiming to have actually seen firsthand something happening before their eyes. Tell me a little bit about these witnesses and why so many of them are so questionable.
Yeah, so what we did is we looked at 11 different media investigations, or 11 different investigations, including the New York Times report and the Physicians for Human Rights Israel, as well as others by outlets such as BBC, Reuters, Washington Post, Associated Press. And it started to become clear that you see the same names over and over again. And furthermore, we can categorize these 12 individuals into various groups. Now, there are some others, but it's really these 12 individuals who account for the vast majority of claims that you see. And one thing to understand is some outlets for completely just, I think, inexplicable, but in reality, bogus reasons would anonymize these sources. There was no reason to do so because we were easily able to identify who they were. And also many of these sources use partial names or they use different spellings of names. There's one individual, Simcha Greineman, who has at least six different spellings of his name. And what this does is it makes it appear that there are many more witnesses than there are. So in terms of these 12 witnesses, five come from this organization called Zaka. And that's what I was referring to in terms of Israel weaponizing these claims. Zaka volunteers were all over the media. And in fact, there are more Zaka volunteers. And they stayed outright. There's one individual in particular, Yossi Lando, who on four different occasions, he's a senior official, he's talked about, we use our imagination. When we go into the houses, the bodies are telling us stories. They're outright saying they fabricate stories. And Yossi Lando was one of the individuals that the Times used for its discredited report. And in a follow-up report, the Times devoted a huge portion to basically whitewashing Zaka and Yossi Lando. Now, he's told all sorts of fabricated stories, such as a pregnant a mother and fetus that was butchered by Hamas. At least four of the 12 witnesses have told this fabricated story. And all the Zaka stories appear to be fabricated. Then three of the witnesses come from a military base, Shura, a military morgue. They've also fabricated stories. Then you have two witnesses who discovered bodies after they had been killed, human remains. One is this paramedic with the elite Israeli search and rescue unit. Another was just a music festival promoter. And so when it comes down to it, there are actually only two witnesses who claim they saw rape. One of them is Roz Cohen. He is former Israeli Special Forces. And then this anonymous witness, only known as peer who initially came to the public via clips from a police video. And both their stories, Cohen's story changes repeatedly. Sapir's is utterly outlandish. She's claiming she saw five gang rapes, Hamas militants carrying around three heads that they were having. She's indicating that they were having sexual relations with the heads. Both Roz Cohen and Sapir are indicating that militants are having sex with corpses. And the fact is, these incidents would have left so much forensic evidence, would have left so much photographic evidence, and yet Israel has not produced any. So what you have of these 12 witnesses, eight of them have fabricated stories. 11 of the 12 are tied to the Israeli military and police. And I'll just say, could we imagine a world in which Hamas militants are putting out stories, they're known to fabricate stories, and they have no evidence whatsoever for their stories, and all the media is like, this absolutely happened, this is true, the way that the New York Times, the New Yorker, BBC, and many other publications have acted like there is solid proof that these rapes happen. And I think the real danger is that this is going to undermine rape as a weapon of war. It does real damage to feminism.
Undermine the seriousness of rape as a,
Undermine the decades of work it's taken to get rape recognized as a weapon of war, because what you'll have in the future is states and non-state actors, when they have credible allegations that they use rape as a weapon of war, they're just going to turn around and say, well, Israel lied and this is just more lies. So this is all extraordinarily dangerous. And as I added, Israel is explicitly using this. They've said this, that they're using the Zaka stories to help them deepen the legitimacy to act with greater force. In other words, they're using atrocity propaganda as cover for genocide. This is why this has to be debunked, because I get people saying, like, well, why does it matter?
Arun, right as your story was on the verge of publication, the United Nations, a United Nations official put out a report that seemed to confirm, again, the same kinds of things that the New York Times and the Physicians for Human Rights Israel put out, a UN envoy, Pramila Patton, and the news... The news headlines coming out of that report again seem to confirm, you know, for example, AP saying a UN envoy says there are reasonable grounds to believe Hamas committed sexual violence on October 7th, convincing information, quote unquote. What do you make of this?
So the UN report is very similar to the Physicians for Human Rights Israel report, because the thing is, they're releasing these reports, you know, that are like a dozen pages. That's a Physicians for Human Rights. The UN report is like 24 pages. And yet in both, the evidence is only 3 pages. That's how thin it is. On top of that is just extraordinary misreporting on the UN report, because if you actually look at the UN report, what Pramila Patton is, first of all, she is not qualified to investigate. She was sent because the UN refuses to cooperate with the Independent Commission of Inquiry that was actually set up to look into these all sorts of aspects of the occupation. And Israel calls them anti-Semitic because they say Israel is engaged in illegal occupation of Palestine. So what Israel did is they really just bullied and browbeat the UN into sending an unqualified, agent to go to Israel to look into this. Secondly, if you look at what she actually says, she says that they relied solely on Israeli authorities, and you know that should be about worth as much as the paper it's written on. In the report, she actually says like Kibbutz Be'eri, where where there's numerous allegations of sexual violence, that they could not find any evidence that there was sexual violence. She says allegations about sexual mutilation and targeting of sexual organs does not, there is no real proof of that whatsoever. She cites various fabricated stories by Yossi Landau, by Sherry Mendez, who we mentioned in our investigation. Both of them claim to have seen this butchered fetus and mother. And she's like, there's no evidence this happened. She says there's no evidence of sexual mutilation of women's organs with metal objects. And so it's what it reads to me like is that she is just someone who is really browbeaten into basically presenting the Israeli side without any real investigation whatsoever. Now, she does say that there's credible allegations at the Supernova Music Festival. But the fact of the matter is when you read, and it's just one short paragraph, many of those allegations are coming from Zaka volunteers, and she can be seen in a photo with Yossi Landau, meaning she is talking to just the biggest fabulist out there. This guy is the George Santos of the October 7th atrocities, and she's taking his word, a known fabricator of stories who admits he invents stories, as somehow proof of credible allegations. So I think this is just, you know, the media didn't read the report. You have a corporate media that has completely just thrown down with genocide. And if there's ever war crime tribunals, I think editors of all these publications should stand trial for incitement to genocide.
And already the New York Times has sort of tried to half-heartedly backpedal from its investigation. Others have tried to poke holes in it. And I should just say for the record that you brought me your version of this story, which centered in January on just the New York Times. You then expanded it to include the Physicians for Human Rights Israel. And so since January, you've been working on this. And you also spoke with something we haven't mentioned on the interview yet, you and I. You spoke at length with Hadass Ziv, who is the main author of the Physicians for Human Rights Israel report. That report, the PHRI report, which has not been as widely debunked, if at all, is also something that lends a lot of credence to these allegations, because it's an organization that has a lot of credibility. It's actually a sort of a leftist organization. It's been very critical of Israel's occupation. It's done some really good work in exposing what Israel is doing in Gaza. Tell me a little bit about this nearly two-hour interview that you had with Hadass Ziv, the author of this PHRI report.
Yeah, so that's right. I came to you and another publication in early January, submitting this article debunking the New York Times report, and the other publication used my reporting and research without credit. So in terms of the Physicians for Human Rights Israel, I had a two-hour conversation that got heated at time. She repeatedly accused me of acting like a prosecutor, questioning a rape victim in court. I finally said to her, not all interviews are friendly. Because when you read the report, first of all she did was Google up the same allegations. And of those 12 witnesses that I talked to, she mentions 8 of them. And in fact, she keeps mentioning one repeatedly. In 4 different footnotes, she mentions Sapir, the woman who claims to have seen this gang rape by 5 women by 100 militants. And, you know, so I was questioning her, like, what is your evidence? And as also, and she didn't have any evidence because she's just Googling up reports. And I'm asking her about, well, did you know that this paramedic from Unit 669, he fabricated stories about a dead baby found in a trash can and about Arabic sentences written on homes in the blood of their victims. Both of these would have left very clear and extensive forensic and photo evidence, and none exist. And she was just like, I was not aware of this. And I asked her, did you look at all available reporting? And she said, yes. And then when I started to ask her about all these fabrications, she said, I didn't realize this. When I told her about Zaka fabrications, she said, you know, this is horrible, you know. And she's like, if I'd known about this, maybe I wouldn't have included them. And as we were going through the report, and as I mentioned, it got pretty heated. She kept saying, like, I stand by my report. But the fact of the matter is she didn't have a leg to stand on. Basically, none of the stories added up. When I was talking to her about Sherry Mendez, who claimed that children and grandmothers were raped until their pelvises were broken and all sorts of, like, atrocities. And Sherry Mendez is this untrained architect who worked as a volunteer cleaning women soldier bodies at the Shura morgue, and all her stories have been debunked. And she's at a morgue. You would expect there'd be a huge amount of forensic evidence, yet none has been shown. And the real story is Israel is fabricating atrocity propaganda to cover for its war. And I think the real way to understand this is that Israel has basically created a modern day version of a 19th century panic that white feminine purity is under attack by savage hordes. Same thing, history we've seen in America during slave rebellions, during the genocide of Native Americans, that white women are under attack, therefore we need to wipe out the savages. That is exactly what's going on. Israel is just a settler colonial state using these old tropes. And unfortunately, Physicians for Human Rights played into it. I could tell that she genuinely believed that, but talking to other people, other leftists in Israel, it's clear that, you know, there's this kind of like just mass groupthink on this rape issue that virtually everyone believes it happened, despite the utter lack of evidence, no photo evidence, no forensic evidence, no survivor testimony whatsoever. And the Physicians for Human Rights, unfortunately, really helped to propel this atrocity propaganda to new heights.
The story that you and I are talking about, Arun, is just out in Yes. It's called Claims of Mass Rape by Hamas Unravel Upon Investigation, an in-depth investigation done by my guest Arun Gupta for Yes Magazine. Kind of unusual for Yes to publish such an investigation. We are a solutions journalism outlet, but we felt this was really important, and it seemed as though at the time, at least in January, it wasn't an easy story to get published. One of the things that I also want to make very clear about is that this story was heavily fact-checked. We have a separate fact-checker that has gone through in detail every single claim made by Arun, and you know, it's a really important way to look at the facts of what's happened on the ground, because facts, I think, are what are missing or are getting mixed in with these fantastical claims. Because I also want to make clear, Arun, it's not as though you and I are saying that Hamas did not kill a whole bunch of people in Israel. It absolutely did. But this idea that they committed mass sexual violence allows Israel to paint them as you point out, and I think you're quoting, human monsters, which, you know, dehumanization is the first step for genocide, right?
Yeah, no, this was, there was an Israeli official in Benjamin Netanyahu's office, basically in the National Information Directorate, which is their propaganda outfit that coordinates propaganda across the government. You know, they use this term Hasbara, which means propaganda explicitly. And he said, you know, the entire state of Israel was fixed on framing the narrative that Hamas equals ISIS immediately after October 7th. And you have Israeli officials like Netanyahu, and then U.S. officials like Biden, Anthony Blinken, Austin, the defense secretary, all saying days after October 7th, Hamas is ISIS, because what this says is that the world needs to wipe out Hamas, and by extension, Palestinians, because the Israelis make no distinction between Palestinians and Hamas. And that's what we've seen that they've done. And the same official, Eitan Schwartz, in Netanyahu's office, he's the one who said that these wonderful men of Zaka, you know, they showed they told these stories to Western reporters, and there was outrage over what human monsters they were, and this deepened the legitimacy of the Israeli state to act with great force. So, you know, what we really see is a concerted, organized propaganda campaign. And I would also recommend that people read my Zaka piece, because their history is just absolutely appalling. This is an organization whose founder appears to have raped hundreds of Israeli children. And so the bitter irony of this all is Zaka, this organization that is propagating what looks to be all these fabricated claims, is responsible for the actual rape of far more Israelis than all the fake rapes of fake Hamas rapes of Israelis combined. And this, I think, is really encapsulate what this whole war is about, right? Where Israel is acting in self-defense to commit genocide. Everything is turned upside down. And I do want to emphasize, this just does such damage, I think, to feminism, to Me Too, to the campaign to get rape as a weapon of war, recognized as a war crime. Israel is utterly cynical and will deploy anything to further its ends.
Arun, I want to thank you so much for joining us. And we'll, of course, link to your story in Yes from Rising Up's website. And good luck to you.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Arun Gupta, investigative journalist whose work has appeared in The Washington Post, The Nation, The Daily Beast, The Raw Story, The Guardian, The Intercept, and Yes Magazine, where his latest story just published, called Claims of Mass Rape by Hamas Unravel Upon Investigation. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. This is Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. A police reform initiative in Washington state to hold law enforcement accountable is facing a test of its effectiveness. Initiative 940, the first of its kind in the nation, strips police of so-called qualified immunity, protecting them from prosecution. In 2018, Washington state's voters passed the initiative after members of the Puyallup tribe mobilized in the wake of the police killing of a young indigenous woman named Jacqueline Salyers. 2 years later, when police killed a black man named Manuel Ellis, just weeks before George Floyd's similar police murder in Minnesota, Initiative 940 was put to the test. Writing in Yes Magazine about how the initiative was passed is my guest, Frank Hopper, Tlingit and freelance native journalist, born in Juneau, Alaska, now living in Tacoma, Washington. He's written a story for Yes Magazine about this particular initiative. Welcome to the program, Frank.
Thank you, Sonali.
So first, let's talk about Jacqueline Salyers, the young indigenous woman. She was from the Puyallup tribe, whose police killing prompted her family, her community, to, first of all, realize that police were protected from prosecution and then actually do something about it. What did they do when she was killed?
Well, the family of Jackie are active in the Puyallup tribe. And they had no idea what to do. But the Puyallup tribe has a history of activism going back into the 1960s, where the tribe fought the state of Washington for fishing rights. They fought the federal government for their support of a puppet tribal government. And went at the standoff at Wounded Knee, they were part of the takeover of Fort Lawton. And so there was a history of activism that the family drew upon. They went to one of their elders named Ramona Bennett, who's now 85 years old. And they told her what had happened, and they asked her what they should do. And she told them that the way to get things done is to get publicity, to get help from other groups, to join other groups for support, and to generate support within the community. And so she suggested they have a march. And so they organized a march from the tribal administration building on the reservation to the federal courthouse in Tacoma. What they found out was a lot of people joined them who were families of other police shooting victims. And they had no idea that there were so many out there that had been affected by police shootings. So they started to have meetings at the tribe's youth center. Every week, the elders of the tribe and the families of other shooting victims got together at these meetings, and they shared what happened to them. And they talked about what they could do. And one of the people that showed up was a Native American man named Rick Williams. And his brother, John T. Williams, had been shot by Seattle police in 2010. And it was such an egregious shooting. They started looking into the laws that allowed the police to get away with it. Because in Washington state, there was a law passed in the 1980s, in 1986, I think it was, that said that police could not be prosecuted for killing a suspect if they were acting in good faith and without malice. And those are two things that you can't really prove in a court of law. You can't really prove that someone in the midst of a conflict or a confrontation with suspects, you can't really prove that the police are acting in good faith. I mean, what does that mean? And they can't really prove that the police officer was acting with malice, which means with evil intent. And so as a result, no prosecutors would prosecute any police that were involved in the use of deadly force because it was just impossible for them to win. And this is sort of what came to light when John T. Williams was shot. And so his brother began campaigning to change the law. And there was a police reform advocate named Lisa Hayes, who helped write an early version of I-940, and it was called Initiative 873. They worked hard to get it put on the ballot. They were out collecting signatures and all that kind of stuff, but they didn't get enough to get their initiative put on the ballot. And so when the community meeting started at the Puyallup Youth Center, Rick Williams showed up just to sort of be a part of it and to, you know, see if he could help. And he already had this initiative written, the early one that didn't make it onto the ballot. And so so the Puyallup tribe pitched in, and they went out and gathered signatures, and you know, they stood in front of grocery stores and things like that. They hired a company to collect signatures, and they went around to all the different tribes in Washington state and explained what they were trying to do, asked for donations to help. And so every single federally recognized tribe in Washington state contributed. Also, several corporate sponsors contributed, like Microsoft actually contributed to help get publicity for the campaign and to help get signatures. And they wound up collecting, I think it was 360,000 signatures. And so this new initiative, Initiative 940, was put on the ballot, was voted on in 2018. And it was voted into law by about two-thirds of the Washington state voters. And so now the requirement to charge police with murder was changed. They took off the malice requirement and the good faith requirement. And so now police in Washington state can be prosecuted for murder if their use of deadly force was unnecessary.
So the Puyallup tribe really mobilized other Indigenous communities, and I imagine non-Indigenous voters as well, to put this on the ballot and to pass it. And then, as I mentioned, Manuel Ellis was killed by police. He was a young Black man. What happened at that point? First of all, what happened to Manny Ellis, and how did the stripping away of qualified immunity play out for the police officers involved in killing him?
Well, Manny Ellis was a 33-year-old Black man who was just returning from a convenience store one night, and he was kind of being rowdy. I guess some people had called in to complain about him, and so they sent the police out, even though he had no history of violence and he wasn't carrying a weapon. He was just being outraged at the way the police were treating him, because since he was a Black man, they felt that they could get away with roughly handling him, and he just had enough. And so he kind of physically resisted being arrested. And so the police, and there were three of them that were eventually charged with his death. And what they did was they tried to restrain him, and they put him down on the ground, face down on the ground. They put a bag over his head, which I guess is like to prevent him from spitting, you know. One of the officers kneeled down on his back, actually on the back of his neck, and did not let him get up, even though he was telling them that he couldn't breathe. And they held him like that for quite a long time. He finally died. And the police at that time were really rough with him. I mean, they were telling him to shut the F up, and, as they were basically strangling him. And he died. And it was all because he was being a little rowdy on his way home from the grocery store, or from a 7-Eleven, I guess it was. So there was a lot of outrage in the community, and there were a lot of meetings that were held, and the police were finally prosecuted. Two of the officers were charged with second-degree murder and manslaughter, and then the third officer was charged with manslaughter. And so there was a trial in Tacoma for these charges. There was finally a decision made.
And if this police, if Initiative 940 hadn't passed by voters, been passed by voters in 2018, by the time Manuel Ellis was killed, would these cops have even been charged?
No, they wouldn't have been charged. And so any investigation relating to the case wouldn't have been made public. It would have been very difficult to get copies of the transcripts or the charging documents, or the being able to put them actually on trial allowed all of the investigations, things like that, to be made public, to become public documents. That was one step in the right direction. It kind of took the investigation out of the dark. The problem was, though, the mostly white jury acquitted the three officers, and so the people in Tacoma, I mean, in at the Puyallup tribe, you know, when they found out, you know, they were pretty depressed about it, because they had gone through years and years of trying to change the law, and they finally did, and then it didn't seem to help. The thing is, they recognized that you can't legislate the way people feel inside their hearts, and because of white privilege, most of the jurors, I think there was like nine jurors that were white and two that were Black and one that was Asian. The thought is that they had no experience with police racism, and so they automatically assumed that whatever the police did was right. And so that's kind of the prevailing opinion about why they were acquitted. And so it's like that the Initiative 940 kind of was a step in the right direction, because it made it possible to charge and try officers for misuse of deadly force. But the next step is to make changes within the community that help the public to see the police as more than just people that are out there kind of protecting us and taking care of us, because they're not really. They're just people. I think that the years and years of white privilege has allowed the verdict to happen. And that's something that's gonna take a long time to change. Incidents like this, you know, bring more publicity to the situation and help people to see that the police are just people, and some of them are bad, and some of them are capable of murder.
I'm wondering, Frank, if you think that the sort of abolitionist approach to what transpired in Washington State with Initiative 940 would have seen this initiative as a reform to a system that really has been a white supremacist system that intends, you know, that is working as intended, not that police killings are an exception, or that police acquittal when they kill is an exception, but this is how the system was built, and the tweaking it and making these tiny reforms doesn't necessarily work, because in the end, the system will continue to protect the perpetrators, the armed perpetrators of harm.
Yeah, that's the concern of the people at the Puyallup tribe and the family of Manny Ellis and all the people that helped to pass the law. They were quite despondent when they found out about it, about the verdict. But, you know, as time has gone by, you know, people have recognized that there's more to 940 than just taking off the malice requirement, because 940 also included things to specify that investigations should occur that are outside the police department. There are several other things that were included in that, and it was actually quite difficult for the people that wrote the initiative to get it passed, because their main opponent was police unions, and so the police, you know, they have this very strong union that no politician wants to go against. And if they're against, you know, a certain thing, that, you know, they're going to get their way. And so really, I think what happened was the public has now a better opportunity to see what it's really like dealing with police violence and unjustified use of deadly force. As they were meeting at the Puyallup Youth Center, and they had no idea that there were so many other families that have been affected by this, and they all came together to write this law and to get it passed. That alone, I think, tells people that there's a lot more unjustified police violence out there than gets put in the news, and that it's much more common than people think. And it's not just a few rogue people or rogue officers. You know, it's a trend, I think, or an aspect of police culture to kind of put the lives of minority people on a lower level than white people or non people of color, and you know, that alone, I think, is going to help open people's eyes.
Well, Frank, I want to thank you so much for joining us. We'll post a link to your story in Yes Magazine. It's called How the Puyallup Tribe Increased Police Accountability in Washington. Good luck to you, and I'm sure we'll have you back on the next time you write about these issues.
Okay, great. Yeah, thank you very much.
My guest has been Frank Hopper, Tlingit, and freelance native journalist born in Juneau, Alaska, now living in Tacoma, Washington, and a contributor for Yes Magazine. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media and host of Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media. You can find this program at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. New issues of Yes Magazine have hit newsstands and mailboxes all over the nation, and this spring 2024 issue is themed around connections, a deeply relevant idea at a time when more people are digitally connected than ever before at the same time as we're still grappling with pandemic-related physical isolation. Joining me to preview this issue is Sanavi Bridham, Managing Editor at Yes Media. Welcome to the program, Sanavi.
Thank you so much for having me, Sonali.
It's lovely to be with you. You and I work together on a daily basis, and we were part of the team that put this issue together. And so let's talk about the digital technology-related stories, the stories centered around social media that made it into this issue. Two really big, deeply reported stories around the role that social media has played in movements. So tell me about these stories.
Yeah, so those are the two stories. The lead feature I edited called Social Media for the Revolution, written by Raina Sultan, and then the piece you edited, of course, Connective Liberation, written by Maria Armudian. And both of these stories look at the ways that social media historically and in the span of history, right, social media is a very recent development when we think about, you know, the whole span of human history. So Raina's piece, which is, I apologize, I'm blanking on the name. Raina's piece, Social Media for the Revolution, really takes a broad historical look at the ways that grassroots organizers in particular have utilized social media to press progressive and liberatory causes forward. And Raina, who is the associate editor at Newsette, brought this pitch to us with a really interesting angle, essentially arguing that the through line and some of the most early adopters of social media, of digital work to connect, to pursue liberation, are actually sex workers who were absolutely early adopters of the internet from the early days of Craigslist. Many sex workers found that the internet offered a platform for them to engage in their work more safely, right? Whether it was, you know, by now we're talking about OnlyFans, we're talking about, you know, digital parameters in which folks can engage in various elements of sex work, to even just vetting potential clients, all of these different elements. So Raina's piece really kind of draws that thread all the way through, and of course then connects, you know, the work that sex workers have been doing around not only decriminalization but just making their work safer. Of course, when we start to see the criminalization of abortion and of reproductive health care, where again many folks are organizing, folks continue to organize to access reproductive health care in states where it's been restricted, much of that organizing happens online and has to happen somewhat surreptitiously. And then Raina draws the through line all the way through to what we're seeing, you know, certainly she discusses Ferguson, the uprising for Black Lives, for Black Lives Matter, to Mike Brown's death, all the way through, of course, to George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, the massive organizing we saw in the uprisings of 2020, all the way through to today, where we are seeing Palestinians, folks in Gaza, documenting genocide in real time. And those of us who are following this are seeing this kind of devastation on our phones, on our screens, beamed into our homes. Meanwhile, we're seeing corporations like Meta, like Twitter, now called X, I'm going to continue to call it Twitter, cracking down on this kind of communication. And then Maria's piece, Connective Liberation, looks a little more at kind of how some of boots on the ground organizing has happened and how social media has supported that sort of organizing. It talks about certainly the uprising for Black Lives, also talks a lot about Occupy Wall Street, which was one of the earlier movements to really leverage digital organizing for in-person action. And that's really kind of this beautiful marriage that we're seeing that I think is clearly powerful because we are now seeing governments and corporations crack down on it. And if it weren't impactful, they wouldn't bother with that.
So then there's also this idea of maybe a little bit more lighthearted stories around how social media makes us feel and also how we end up, you know, how we have been connected. I'm specifically talking about the way in which people tend to... Society gets frayed when we envy one another, which social media unfortunately encourages, but then society also mobilizes when we have ways to connect, as Yvette Dion, our executive editor, points out in her Memoriam to Black Twitter, which is a sort of obituary, if you will, to the social media platform that had played such a huge role in so many movements, not the least of which was the 2020 racial justice uprising. And so, you know, it's really interesting that this issue has examined both sides of the coin when it comes to digital technology. There is good, there is bad. right?
Absolutely, right? And that's something Yes always aims to do, right, is complicate the narrative. There, you know, very rarely in our world is any issue black and white. Yes lives in the gray. We aim to complicate that narrative and help folks understand the context and offer folks information that they need to be able to form their own opinions. I love Yvette's piece about Memoriam for Black Twitter. She really, I think, captures the incredible cultural moment that was Black Twitter. It was in some ways this organic creation, right? I don't believe that the folks who developed Twitter believed that it would become a hub for Black culture and commentary and humor, right? As well as cultural critique, right? We absolutely saw, as you mentioned, right, Twitter being pivotal to the uprisings in 2020 and preceding. Would we have known about the uprisings in Ferguson and Mike Brown's death if we hadn't seen it on Twitter? Maybe not. Maybe we would have had the police narrative that we so often see claiming that these were violent riots. But we've also seen, you know, truly Twitter and Black Twitter in particular defined culture in a way that was really unique. And I appreciate in Yvette's piece that she names that it's unknown where that will go, right? Since Elon Musk's takeover of Twitter, Yvette has this great line, and I think we put it in the subhead, the deck for the piece, that, you know, Twitter was once a bastion of culture, a culture maker, and it is now more like a sundown town, right? The platform privileges alt-right, white supremacist perspectives over those of folks from more historically marginalized communities. And it's really become a hostile environment. And at this point, nothing has stepped in to fill the gap. That doesn't mean that nothing will, but I appreciate Yvette for naming the value of this platform, because we do need to grieve those as well, right? Like, that's a piece of culture that perhaps we're losing.
We also had a wonderful spread in, or we have a wonderful spread in the winter issue about the price that we pay for all of the connections that we have, literally the physical price that we pay, and that is the weight of the cloud. I loved this piece. This was overseen by our colleague Brianna Draxler. Tell me about this incredible, you know, it's our Just the Facts spread, so it's very visual.
Exactly. I love the way this came together. You're correct. It's Just the Facts. It's our infographic spread, so our story in data. And, you know, Brianna brought this idea to the team because we think about, you know, we know our data lives in the cloud, right? We pay however much I pay for, you know, my Apple iCloud storage or Google Photo storage. And we don't really think about, like, where that lives. And it turns out that data actually lives in physical data centers, right, that consume incredible amounts of natural resources, energy, not to mention the rare earth metals that power many of not only our devices, but then these data centers. And just like we so often see, these industrial data centers are frequently placed in communities that are historically marginalized. They're often placed in communities of color. And there is literal environmental pollution. There is noise pollution. And I think, you know, this piece really explores this impact in a way that I think most folks don't think about, right? Because we just think, oh yeah, you know, I've posted this into the cloud. It's safe. It just lives literally in the cloud. But there's physical infrastructure here that has an environmental toll. And I really appreciate the way that this piece explored that. And Stephen Gonzalez Monserrate, who wrote the piece, actually drafted this piece and then took a bunch of the research he worked for with us to go speak at the UN about this exact issue. So it's really an example of Yes being kind of on the cutting edge and really being a part of conversations that are happening at a global level as we start to interrogate our impact and what our data does in the world, because it doesn't just exist in the ether.
And there isn't just a digital connectivity that we tackle, but real life connectivity as well. So, so important, because we are ultimately human beings. We need to sit face to face with one another. And so I loved the story that that you brought to this issue, Safe Sacred Spaces. Tell me about this. You know, as an atheist, I loved this story.
I love hearing that. Safe Sacred Spaces is about It's by Sarah Youngblood Gregory, one of our contributors who covers LGBTQ rights for Yes. And it's a beautiful piece about the ways that LGBTQ people are creating faith spaces where their identity is a blessing, not a sin, particularly within the Christian faith, right? There are many faith communities within the U.S. That said, Christianity is the dominant religion in this country. And Christianity is also where most LGBTQ people have experienced religious harm, either from growing up in the church or seeking community in the church and being ostracized, being told who they love, who they are is a sin. And she opens with a really interesting anecdote about some allegedly progressive moves from Pope Francis, who announced that transgender people can be baptized in the Catholic Church and that priests may bless individual same-sex unions. But the catch is, as long as those unions do not resemble marriage, which doesn't make sense to me, right? It's these, and both of those proclamations come with caveats that as long as those blessings, those baptisms, do not cause confusion among the faithful, right? So Sarah has this line that just sticks with me, where she talks about how LGBTQ people have for too long been expected to be grateful for scraps of food of a well-fed faith at a table. And I think it's just a powerful visual about what LGBTQ people are so often expected to accept within their faith communities, right? Where we accept this, love the sinner, hate the sin. But if the alleged sin is a central part of who you are, how much can you love an individual? So this piece is really kind of classic solutions journalism from Yes. It looks at the ways that different folks across the country are carving out faith communities, right? They did not find affirming spaces in their own communities, in their own religious traditions, their own religious denominations. So they're creating their own, and they are finding beauty and healing and community and connection. Because for so many people who were raised in faith communities, that connection is really central, not only to a higher power, but to other folks who share those beliefs. And for many LGBTQ people who have experienced religious harm and ostracization, they lose that connection, but they're often still seeking it. So it's a beautiful piece looking at ways that grassroots organizers are creating those spaces in real time, are carving out churches, centers, for LGBTQ people and anyone who has felt othered by their faith tradition to come and find a home, find a spiritual home that affirms them and accepts them and tells them that there's nothing wrong with who they are. And I think it's a really beautiful piece.
Well, there's so much to discuss. I encourage our viewers and listeners to pick up a copy at your local newsstand or subscribe to get a hold of the magazine and go through, you know, so many more stories that we didn't even get to in detail. But let's wrap up our conversation, Sanavi, with a mention of the art that goes into making these magazines so visually beautiful. We think of the physical magazine these days as kind of a dinosaur, a dying breed of, you know, news sharing. But there's something so beautiful about holding sort of a mini book in one's hand that's very visually appealing. And we've got some talented people at ES who put it together. So even the cover itself is quite stunning, right?
The cover is stunning. And the cover is a photograph by Andreas Vardo from his series on surreal photography. It's this incredible image. And I really have to give so much credit to our art director, Natalie Pryor, who continues to knock it out of the park. We bring her broad kind of esoteric themes, and Natalie continues to find photographs and artists who not only do the theme justice, but really are provocative and thought-provoking in their representation. And I think that's very true of this cover, where we see this, you know, a woman holding up her phone, taking a selfie. She's surrounded by these kind of just disembodied thumbs up at the bottom, and then we see in her arm there's a crying child. And it just speaks so much to this, I think, moment where we want to present our beautiful, you know, best angled selves online without, to get all of these likes, all these thumbs ups, without really acknowledging the reality of what's happening around us, of the complexity, the difficulties that we might be facing. And I think, you know, the ways that impacts the people around us, right? We present these idealized versions of ourselves online so often, and that leads other folks who are struggling maybe in the same ways we are to think that they are alone. And it contributes to that isolation that then we posit in this issue, connection can be a cure for.
Sanavi, thank you so much. And people can subscribe, as I mentioned, to Yes Magazine. You can ask your local newsstands to carry it. And we also do have a digital version for those who just prefer that. And that's at yesmagazine.org. Thank you again, Sanavi.
Thank you so much for having me, Sonali.
Sanavi Bridenham is managing editor at Yes Media, and I'm Sonali Kulhatkar, senior editor at Yes Media, and also host of this program, Yes Presents Rising Up with Sonali. You can find this show at yesmagazine.org, watch it on Free Speech TV, and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Our audio podcast is on iTunes and Spotify.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO.